From the Sky News Centre at 5, a gang involved in grooming and raping girls in Rotherham have been jailed for a total of more than 100 years. Six people were convicted on Wednesday. They include three brothers from a British-Pakistani family. The Prime Minister says they could be deported and their British status revoked.
If people have dual citizenship, then you can take away their British citizenship in some circumstances. We've legislated very clearly for that in terms of terrorist offences, and I think this is something absolutely that needs to be looked at.
Three British tourists have died while climbing waterfalls in a popular tourist spot in Vietnam. The bodies of one man and two women have been recovered and a tour guide is being questioned by police. Some migrants living at a camp in Calais called The Jungle have begun leaving after a judge ruled part of it can be demolished. Charity workers say people have started departing on buses provided by French authorities. The head of Ofsted is warning that England's schools are struggling because teachers are being tempted abroad. Charlie Lewis reports.
What does a good teacher make these days?
Despite the adverts, recruitment and retention are still big problems for the government. Teacher Chris Lee went to work in Singapore attracted by the perks.
Things like flight home, accommodation, school fees for children, health insurance, low taxes.
Ofsted chief Sir Michael Wilshaw wants new teachers given financial incentives to keep them in England. But Kevin Courtney from the NUT reckons there are bigger issues.
Actually, the real problem in our classrooms is excessive workload.
The government says it's investing millions of pounds in teacher recruitment.
Emergency services say it's possible another section of the disused Didcot power station could collapse. Teams are still searching rubble at the site where three people are feared dead. And some breaking news just reaching us in the last few minutes. Gianni Infantino has been elected the new FIFA president. He replaces outgoing president Sepp Blatter. Well, that's the latest. I'm Simon English. Weather. Sponsored.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is independent candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Paul Savile. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, around the time of last year's autumn statement, Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne revealed he'd be buying an extra 100 F-35B Lightning jets for the RAF and Royal Navy, specifically to equip Britain's new aircraft carriers. Soon after, the US Congress revealed they would be cutting back on their orders for the F-35 because of spiralling costs and lack of reliability, cracks appearing in the wings. Lack of manoeuvrability raising serious questions over whether Lockheed's state-of-the-art jet was even up to the job. With costs put at between £80 and £200 million each for the F-35, meaning a programme cost of around £20 billion, is it time to open the air brakes on the scamjet? And according to former Italian mafia man, today's multinational corporations have begun modelling themselves on the world's most ruthless and successful narco cartels. Is he right? And never mind the human rights, EU companies are selling illegal surveillance software to human rights abusing regimes, where it's not illegal. Former Nazi company Siemens helping the Egyptian military ruler al-Sisi make sure nothing like the Arab Spring can ever happen there again. And talking of cybercrime, it seems our very own GCHQ in Cheltenham is instrumental in making the virus designed to attack nuclear power plants, allowing reactors to run out of control. Is it time to close the Cheltenham Donut down and expose these international cyber criminals? And as China suggests a Palestinian state headquartered in East Jerusalem, is Netanyahu determined to evict all the Arabs from the city? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 2 Celsius, pretty chilly, dry but windy. This weekend, highs of 7, a mainly cloudy weekend, windier on Saturday though. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, some sunny spells, showers and windy. Next weekend, the 5th and 6th of March, highs of 7 Celsius, cloudy with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is independent candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Paul Savile. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Tell us why you're standing again, or actually, no, for the first time, because you're in the process of putting an application together to actually stand for Mayor this time.
Yeah, I didn't plan to run for Mayor 6 months ago. So it was around October. I kind of thought, well, why not? One of my friends more recently said, why are you running for mayor? And I said, well, why aren't you running for mayor? So, but I'm concerned with the way the city's going at the moment, Tony, for lots of people, and I want to be that voice and hopefully be that change.
No, why are you concerned? What's getting you goat?
On everyone's lips at the moment is the housing and homelessness crisis. The Bristol Post, I think it was last week, reported that over 1,000 homes still empty, unoccupied in Bristol, yet thousands of people are sleeping on the streets. This has a massive impact on not just the people that are having to sleep rough or sofa surf, but on the whole city. You know, it affects everyone, and we are all connected.
There was a statistic this week I noticed that the Wild Goose Cafe, which supplies free meals for people in the evenings, has had, since Cameron came to power 5-6 years ago, a sevenfold increase in the number of people who are queuing up every evening for their free meals.
Yeah.
So I just wonder what you make of why homelessness is increasing so rapidly.
I don't think there's one explanation for it. I think there's lots of reasons for it. There's the kind of new wave of people moving to Bristol, pushing their property prices up. Also, you know, we've got a situation where lots of people have land and some people have none. And, you know, there's a house which we've been looking at. I made a video of it. It's on YouTube. If you type in the Tale of Two Cities, Bristol. And it's basically a four-storey house just by Clifton Downs. It's been empty 2.5 years. It's got massive gardens, and it's unoccupied. It's a commercial building, and, you know, we're living in... It really is the tale of two cities for me. Some people are doing very well out of this situation, and some people are really, really not. And I'm hopefully going to try and... inspire people to get involved, really.
Well, tell us a bit about yourself. What's your background?
So I came to Bristol in 2007 to study sociology and criminology. That was at UWE. I just got through my degree. I was involved in a lot of kind of political campaigns at the same time. So I kind of dragged myself through my degree, and I did graduate in the end. But I moved here in 2007 and just stayed. I love Bristol. I love everything about it. I'm an artist, campaigner, I sell tea, I have a little business down on the roundabout, bottom of Stokescroft, and
You charge £2 for a cup of tea. That's quite a lot, Paul.
It depends. If you've got no money, then you don't pay. If you have got money, then you pay. And if you haven't got any money today, but you've got some money next week, then that's you can pay next week.
Do you
week.
Find people take advantage of that?
There's a couple of people who come most days and say, can I have a free one? And some days I'll say yes, and some days I'll say no. But generally speaking, people are good about it, you know. It's a trust thing. It's a trust thing.
Also, I mean, in the Bristol Post this week, shocking figures, 5,600 households in Bristol became or were threatened with homelessness last year. I mean, this figure is going up on the rise in the city. They're saying... that it's a troubling increase of 14% on figures for the previous year. George Ferguson admits it's fast becoming one of the council's most pressing concerns. What do you think the council are actually doing about it? What have you know, evidence have you got? Because I remember on Points West, this is probably November time last year, we had George down in Southfield saying he's going to open up council properties for homeless people.
So I think it was 19 days before Christmas Day. The promise was that there would be buildings open. They haven't been opened. There's 20 more beds in the Jamaica Street, in the Compass Centre, which they're not actually bedrooms, it's just a crash space, is what the terminology is. you know, we need radical action, actually. We need to think outside the box on the whole housing issue, about not just chuck people in a house and say that's where you're living now, because as you can see with lots of the hostels, it's just this kind of cycle that never gets broken, and people just falling into the hard drugs. What we need to provide is a real base for people to not just exist from, but to really build their lives back up and actually be part of a community. So for me, it's not just about building new homes, which is what a lot of the other candidates are saying, but actually providing spaces where people are actually part of Bristol, you know.
The evidence is, if you walk around, you'll see in quite a lot of parks, green spaces, open spaces, tents springing up. Mm. The council's solution seems to be, if Nick Hooper's word is anything to go by, who's the council officer in charge of all this sort of thing, is to wait till people leave their tents and then possibly confiscate those tents, because he wants them to be visible, well, people to be visible, and you're not visible when you're in a tent.
I was at a housing and homelessness hosting event yesterday, which interestingly I wasn't invited to, nor were two of the other independent candidates, but Carl Mann, I think you've had him on your show recently, is that right? Carl spoke to me yesterday after the hustings, and he said, oh, I've had a really interesting conversation with George Ferguson. I said, well, what did he say? And he said that basically he's made a promise to Carl that on his watch, well, until he's not mayor anymore, or, you know, until it's up again, that there'll be no evictions of any tents in Bristol from now on, unless there's some kind of public order offence, or, you know, someone's leaving mess and debris, then the council will not, under any circumstance, evict tents, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if people want to hear Carl, he's on our dialect show, which was week before last. If you go up to dialectradio.co.uk, dialect will be coming back, I'm pleased to say, midday Tuesdays in the next couple of weeks here on to BCFM. What do you make of Carl's initiative? He's trying to do quite a lot as a homeless person himself, isn't he?
Yeah, the homeless pay it forward. I've just been with him in town, actually. There's an event going on where there's kind of a silent protest in the centre of Broadmead. Lots of cardboard put down and sleeping bags. And, you know, it's just basically highlighting how many empty homes there are in Bristol at the moment. And the fact that people are still sleeping out on the streets. You know, my campaign isn't solely involved in the housing thing, but actually transparency in our council and calling for more inclusiveness in the processes that go on in our council. And really, I think that the council needs to be reminded that they work for us. We pay their wages.
There's also been reports this week about homeless spikes being installed by the galleries.
Yeah. So that's an interesting one. I've got to say, big shout out to Pete, actually. Pete was the guy who, the spikes got put up, to stop people sleeping there, basically. They were up for 24 hours, and in typical Bristol style.
Just whereabouts were they, for those that know the galleries?
So Union Street, so if you're on the left, where, the Waterstones is, or just on that left, the back door to Waterstone.
Okay,
just before.
So it's sort of next to Castle Park, really, basically.
Yeah. on that hill, opposite KFC and Wilkinson's, the galleries management decided to put bollards there. I think there was six or seven in
a
kind
of...
Yeah,
great big spikes, weren't they, actually? Metal things.
Yeah, but in typical Bristol style, 24 hours later, they've been removed. Great campaign, and lovely Pete Wentland, he went there one day, and he put two bunches of daffodils... And a welcome mat that you got from Poundland or something. And then someone put a bookshelf there. And then someone put two cushions there. And then someone put some pillows in the sleeping bag there. And it's a real act of solidarity to say that, actually, you know, we're not like the rest of the, you know, we're Bristol, we're different, we care about people.
You said something as well a minute ago, which is a bit worrying, that even though you're standing for mayor, that there were hustling events that you weren't invited to, and you had to actually go online, did you say, to research these? I'm
yeah.
not sure. So what's going on there?
So the first one I've heard of was at St Brendan's School, and I think that was about 2 weeks ago, and I heard about the event after it had happened, and I was quite disappointed, really, because I was saying to you earlier, no one's an official candidate until those nomination papers are handed in. Not even George Ferguson, who's current mayor.
I mean, it has been made public that you're standing, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we should all, in any kind of democratic election, you should kind of have equal, you know,
Well, we do on this show. We make sure that everybody is, you know, in some way or other represented, whether it's with a short interview, even just something from their manifesto talked about, even if they're not in on a main you know, we have to do that, basically, Ofcom rules. So, what did you see when you actually did manage to make it to one of these hustings?
So, I mean, yesterday was the homelessness and housing forum. They put up these hustings, and I tried to find out, the night before, where the hustings were going to be, and we spent about 2 hours on the internet trawling it. We found this, it was this Bristol Housing Forum page, and it suggested that it was at their station down in town, you know, next to Bridewell Police Station. I went there in the morning and it wasn't there, so she sent me, this woman, she said, oh, we'll go and try Elim Church in Stokes Croft. So I popped up there, and he said, oh no, I've got no idea what you're talking about, try the old death centre around the corner. So we went there, and the guy there didn't know what we were talking about, so we kind of resigned to the fact that we weren't going to find it. And then I just said to my friend Kaz, should we just try in the Jamaica Street Hostel. Pressed the doorbell and the guy answered, and I said, oh, we're here for the hustings. I made sure I said, we're actually here for them, not are they here, we are here for them. And he said, oh, just be down now. He came out, he said, oh, can you just sign your name here? And then we went, and it was so odd because I am a candidate, not official, like I say, yet, but there was two seats available and they're right at the front. And so Kaz and I, my friend, we sat down, and there was on the left George Ferguson, independent, or Bristol First, whatever, I'm not really sure of that situation. Marvin Rees, Tony Dyer, Marvin Rees, Labour, yeah. Tony Dyer, Green, Kay Barnard, Lib Dem, UKIP, Paul Turner, and Charles Lucas, Conservative. And that was it. So there's missing three candidates there. It was an interesting thing because, you know, I'm sat there as a part of the audience, and actually I really wanted to be involved in that process, and I've got some really radical ideas that could change the lives of everyone. I want
to. Did anyone explain to you why you weren't invited?
No, I mean the chair of this hustings was from ITV. I'm not sure what his why he was chosen or whatever, but I did say, why wasn't I invited? And he said, well, that's, you know, just how it's gone. There's no real explanation to it.
And what about afterwards? Because it seems that the business community take a great interest in these hustings.
So after that hustings, I left, and as I left the homeless shelter on Jamaica Street, there was two guys stood outside, and I recognised one of them because I see a lot of people in through the day, you know, down at the tricycle. And he said to me, what are you doing here, Paul? And I said, oh, I've been here for the mayoral hustings. I said, you know, George Ferguson and the rest are in there. He said, I wanted to be in a nut. I said, well, why didn't you go? He said, well, my support worker told me we weren't allowed to go. I said, well, that's terrible. You know, you're part of the Bristol community, and it directly affects him because he is homeless and he wasn't invited. So, I mean, I'm not alone. It seems like there's, you know, select people. But then when I left that hustings, I found out that that there'd been a business hustings between Marvin Rees, Labour, the Charles Lucas, the Conservative candidate, and George Ferguson, and that was it.
Where and when was that then?
I'm not sure where that was. Again,
is this a Wednesday evening thing then?
I don't know. I mean, I'm spending a lot of my evenings trying to track down hustings and what's going on, and it's actually really time consuming.
So we're in a bit of a weird period though, aren't we? Because I think I'm right in saying it's the end of March that all the documents and everything have to be filled in for Stand for Mayor. So although all the campaigns are going, there is a possibility for people. I mean, if I wanted to on here, I could just have the same person on every week, or the same two or three people from the main political parties on every week talking. I don't want to do that. Martin, it just sounds as if there is a bit of liberty being taken here, excluding candidates like Paul, who are independent. Now, of course, when George Ferguson first stood for mayor 4 years ago, he was himself an independent candidate.
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems you've got to recognise is that people who organise hustings are not actually working to any kind of rule book. Anybody can organise a hustings and invite people to come along, and they can invite who they like and not invite the people they don't like. And so it's not the case that you can make whoever's organising a particular hustings invite everybody. We're, as you say, ruled by Ofcom, so we have to make sure that, for example, we might not interview everybody who's standing, but we've got to make sure that people know who the candidates are, so you have to read through the list of candidates. And to be honest with you, I shall probably be involved in the campaign, although I've been a bit lazy about it thus far. Hustings, frankly, often are not what the candidates want to be doing. They don't actually communicate with a very large number of people. They're very time-consuming. And, you know, frequently candidates will want to be actually out talking to people at random rather than talking to people who've invited themselves to a hustings.
Having studied sociology, Paul, you know, this is one of those things I think quite often when I see things like Question Time on BBC is I wonder whether politicians are there kind of to set the bounds of the debate rather than to actually make decisions. We haven't had, for example, much critique from George Ferguson of the whole idea of austerity at all, have we?
No. Just going back to what Martin said, that's interesting actually about, you know, the time. Perhaps, you know, maybe I shouldn't be focusing all my energies onto hustings and, you know, be out with the real, not the, you know what I mean, the real people on the street, you know.
When I go to hustings, and I have gone to some in the past, you generally find that the only people there are committed to one candidate or another.
Yeah.
You very rarely find random people turning up. In the old days, you know, back in the 19th century, the hustings were a very important way of communicating with the electorate because there was no radio and all the rest of it. But the modern campaigning puts hustings at a fairly low level. Although, I mean, the hustings we've had on here at the last mayoral election, I think, were worthwhile because you've got virtually everybody there apart from Marvin, who didn't turn up. And that was his decision. He doesn't turn up.
There's another side to this. I don't want to get too bogged down here, but there is another side to this, and that is, of course, that the hustings do tend to get press coverage quite often. There'll be someone from the press who'll cover it, and the candidates know that. But let's get back to this whole idea of what politicians are, Paul. What do you know? You've studied sociology. You've been living quite close to street level in the city for a reasonable time now. What would you do if you were elected? I think to change things. How do you see the role of a politician?
I think if you ask people on the street that question, I think a lot of people have been quite bored out of politics, that it's nothing to do with you, that it's something that's done in the corridors of power, that you just pay your taxes and put a cross in a box every, you know, 4 or 5 years and we'll do the rest. For me, democracy doesn't stop at the ballot box, certainly not. And it's actually about everyday processes. And I think if you change the word of politics to your life, or how much the bus costs, or what school your children go to, or, you know, insert your own question there, people were suddenly interested. So for me, it's about actually involving people into these processes, in the council decision-making processes, but also in everyday life. So if we can try and devolve that power and that responsibility and trust in people and communities to make their own decisions, because I don't know where you live, Tony, but I'm pretty sure that you know your area better than I do. You know what goes on and what the problems are, and who better to sort out your problems than yourself and your neighbourhood?
A large part of it, though, is about the 3,500, I think it is, 4,000 or 5,000, something like that, of our money that the council spends every year on and prioritising how that's spent.
How much?
What would you? I think isn't it a £350 million budget, and we've got. I'm not sure exactly how much it is per person, but it's roughly that. So that's a large part of the job of a politician is to decide how that money's spent. You know, this is our big public money pot. This is why people have got so annoyed about this whole Bristol Green Capital, and me too, is that vast amounts of public money, of ours, has been spent by people who don't want to say how they spent it.
It's down to accountability again, isn't it? I mean, who does the council work for? Are they working for Bristolians?
There's also things like that when we're talking about housing, as you've been doing. This term affordable housing is trotted out all the time. Of course, really, it should be called unaffordable housing.
I mean, in this hustings yesterday, the kind of across the panel, the words were, we need to build more affordable homes. But like my suggestion was a little bit more radical, is we don't, well, sure, build new homes, of course. But there's over a thousand homes right now in this city, which are completely habitable, but are unoccupied. Get them open tomorrow. get people with a base to live in, suddenly those people who are, you know, finding themselves in situations of hard drugs and rough sleeping will suddenly be off the street and maybe actually have a chance to rebuild their lives.
What Paul Mason was saying in The Guardian recently, Martin, was that that there absolutely has to be a tax on property that's not being used.
Well, I would totally agree with that. I mean, the housing situation in this country has become beyond a scandal. It's absolutely ludicrous. And I welcome anybody trying to raise awareness about it. Because, of course, it's a very cynical game that's being played by the Conservative government. They are basically subsidising their supporters to get on the housing ladder in the marginal constituencies. At the same time, that's using public money, and that's what they mean by affordable housing, giving handouts to the people who are likely to vote for them. And, of course, the other scandalous thing they're doing is selling off the housing stock of the housing associations, which doesn't even belong to the government, but they're forcing the housing associations to sell it to existing tenants, which again will shrink the number of homes available to those on low incomes. And the whole thing is building up a property bubble out of which, you know, the Duke of Westminster is the biggest landowner in Britain, will be substantially richer by the end of the housing bubble. And when the bubble bursts, some of these first-time buyers are going to be left in negative equity. And none of it makes any difference at all to people on the bottom rung. The universal credit means that lots of private landlords won't rent to people on benefits anymore. And, of course, if you're not got a stable address, your chances of registering to vote are minimal. And in fact, we've got less people registered to vote now than at the last election in this country, yeah, even though we've got a bigger population. And that is all part of the plan. Basically, they don't want the poor to register to vote. And if you deprive them of housing, then they won't be able to register to vote, and therefore their needs are not going to be met.
That's
fundamental gerrymandering that's going on.
Sounds to me like a third world model sort of of government. Now,
it is.
We're going to switch the subject now and have a look at this racist murder last week. Just actually, it was being announced on the news, headlining as we were doing this show this time a week ago, and that was in Rochdale. Guy in his 80s, oh no, hang on, I think he was in his 70s, was murdered on the way home from mosque. Now, this is really setting a pattern of cowardly attacks by young men, it seems, on elderly Muslims travelling to or from mosques. This has happened in various different places, Walsall, Rotherham, and now Rochdale too. And I spoke to the daughter of someone who was murdered a few years ago in Birmingham. Her name is Maz Salim, and she's a campaigner on racism, anti-racist campaigner, about this and how it fits in with these three different murders, and also how some of them have not had any kind of national publicity whatsoever.
I'm an anti-racism campaigner, and I'm the daughter of Mohammed Salim, who was brutally murdered in Birmingham in April 2013. Since my father's passing, I've been very active speaking and standing up against racism and Islamophobia. So I speak on many platforms, from the Teachers Union to Stand Up to Racism platforms, Stop the War Coalition on Islamophobia and the War on Terror.
Any racist murder is upsetting, particularly though when it's of an elderly gentleman. We've had three of these murders now in Britain, have not really been connected, certainly by the national press.
My father, Mohammed Salim, was murdered on the 29th of April 2013. He was 82 years old at the time. He was pulled out and murdered in Smalley from the very road he'd lived on for over 30 years. And he was murdered allegedly because he was brown and dressed like a Muslim. My father was followed from the mosque after evening Isha prayers by a Ukrainian neo-Nazi terrorist who had been in the country for less than a week. My father was then stabbed brutally three times from behind. Now, in August 2015, last year, Mohsin Ahmed, who was 81 years old, was on his way to mosque for Fajr prayers, which are the morning prayers, and he was attacked and brutally beaten to death. He was stamped and kicked, and the court case has just come to court, and the details have gone into what they actually did to him. It's truly, truly horrific what they actually did to him. They stamped on him, and they kicked him and punched him, and they actually found the perpetrators by the footprint on his face from the trainers was one of the perpetrators. So those details have come out in court today, actually. And then just last week, we've had the murder of a very pious imam from the mosque, Jalal Uddin, who was on his way home from mosque, exactly like Dad, Isha prayers, and he was brutally beaten to death. The police at the moment have two suspects, but they have not mentioned the race or the identity of the suspects as yet. Similarly, with Dad's case, when Dad was initially murdered, he took 3 months to find Pablo Lapshin, because when we told him this was a racist attack, they wouldn't believe us, and they, you know, we had to convince them. Now, with Mohsin Ahmed, similarly the same. He was brutally murdered by racists, drunken racists. This has been reported today in the press. And again, at the time, Sheffield Gazette was the only paper that reported on this death. Now, with the murder last week of the imam, he was, again, brutally beaten to death, found on the floor. But the fact, what really upsetting is, we should be seeing all these as hate crimes. If you find an elderly man on the floor, beaten to death or stabbed to death, you know, it's instantly, we should look at it, you know, as a hate crime first and then anything otherwise. But what they've done here with this case last week, apparently it was reported that he had fallen and hit his head, but clearly the injuries on his head, which were reported in the press, were really severe. Instantly, people who were there, the mosque goers, have said it didn't look like he'd fallen. So it's not been seen as a hate crime as yet, and police are investigating, obviously, within the community again. I mean, this case last week did get a good lot of reports regarding this death, and that's the first time in a long time. So that was good. But on the other hand, the Times did report a really disgusting and disgraceful headline in regards to this imam's death, saying he was a man murdered in a sex grooming town, which is like, why would you link the two? It's nothing to do with the imam. So it's the lack of reporting, and then when it is reported, it's not reported in the right manner.
Can you understand the police when they say, well, we are very reluctant to say something's a hate crime when we don't have the evidence?
It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, if it's the other way around, and I mean, if there was a white elderly person on the floor, and maybe there was 3 Asian guys running away from you, it'd be automatically seen as a race crime. And with Dad's case as well, like, you know, the people, you know, witnesses saw the perpetrators running away, but, you know, again, you know, it still wasn't seen as a hate crime. And the CCTV images were very grainy images, considering what the counter-terrorism gave us, but what the neighbours gave us, you can clearly see it was a white person. So it is absolutely disgraceful how Muslim hate crimes are reported in comparison to the way, if it was the other way around. There was more than one attacker. There was a suspect vehicle following my dad from behind, which the police dismissed, and that car had a lot to do with this crime. And if you look at actually the CCTV yourself, you'll see all the footage of Pablo, and none of them look like him. So, you know, I was showing this to my friend today. I said, look at these 4 images of Pablo, and they look completely different. So, and, you know, also, like, you know, neighbours as well, like, you know, what they heard and saw on the night. So we know that there was more than one attack.
Also, there is this potential link to the kind of war agenda with Islam, because, I mean, we've looking at the countries that have been attacked by America and Britain over the last few years, a lot of them are Islamic countries.
What's happening is Muslims being like constantly seen as terrorists, and, you know, this Islamophobic agenda, and Cameron's recent comments to Muslim women saying that we don't integrate, you know, that we can't speak English, and we are traditionally submissive, but he actually doesn't even know us. You know, he hasn't a clue, you know, about us. So, you know, he's come out with all this rubbish recently, attacking Muslim women. So, you know, in a current climate of where Islamophobia is burning and fueling around the world, look what Donald Trump's bigotry in the USA. You look at what's happening in Australia. You know, here in the UK, you know, these are the last things you need, is our own government fueling to these Islamophobic times.
What advice have you got for the police?
There's stories about, you know, the grooming scandal in Rotherham, and the far right are very ripe in both these towns, in Rochdale and in Rotherham. So the police need to also keep their eye on what they are doing and what their movements are around mosques. Because this last year, at the same mosque where this imam has been murdered last week, the Britain First were outside that mosque saying no more mosque. Now, as soon as this imam was murdered just last week, a few hours later, Britain First are posted up on their wall, like basically mocking the death, like saying that, like, we were here at the same mosque. It's so they provoke people to write the most disgusting comments underneath that post. So they actually put up their no more mosques where they were at the same mosque where the imam died. Now, the police need to obviously look at the far right and look how rife they are in the areas as well and consider them as suspects first and foremost, instead of investigating the Muslim community first and foremost, which is what they tend to do.
What did you learn about the police and the way they investigate these crimes with regard to your father's case?
The West Midlands Police, I think they were very, very challenging. Every time we tried to speak to them, they weren't listening to us. When we said it was a hate crime and it was a racist attack, they weren't listening to us. They were investigating the community for Dad's death. They were investigating even us as well. So we weren't happy with the West Midlands Police. But the counter-terrorism unit were brilliant and they were really understanding and very supportive and seemed a lot more professional at their job. And so that was from our personal experience. And that's why I decided to campaign, because I feel like when such crimes happen, the lack of reporting, in comparison, especially with Lee Rigby's death and Dad's death, Dad was murdered on the streets in a terrorist attack. Lee Rigby was murdered 3 weeks after, and we had worldwide condemnation, you know, Muslims apologising, the police doing cobra meetings, Theresa May, and then with Dad's death, it was nothing of the sort. It was a deafening silence, actually, a complete deafening silence. So, so that's why I think I actively campaign today to, obviously, we need to stand up to racism and we need to stand up to Islamophobia. We need to stand up and challenge our right-wing government who are fueling the hate on our streets at the moment.
That was Maz Salim there speaking to me yesterday. Her father was killed 3 years ago in Birmingham. Martin, one of the most worrying things she's talking about there is effectively it sounds like a bit of a turf war going on with the police, with the local police saying, well, we want this to be our investigation. We don't want to call it a terrorist attack. Then we can do the investigation. And eventually having to get out of the way and let the counter-terrorism unit come in and do the job.
Well, that's quite interesting because, in general, I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque some years ago, and what I actually said was you should cooperate with the local police, but don't cooperate with counter-terrorism police and with special branch MI5, etc. I think that we are living in very dangerous times where people are. We're on a knife edge of potential for violence of all kinds, and the police have to be seen to be and to really be above racist profiling and all the rest of it.
What about this assertion there, though, that the police are saying, well, we're very, very reluctant to call it some kind of racist attack because that may actually cause more trouble?
My answer to that is it a racist attack? I mean, sometimes attacks aren't racist.
Well, they were
sometimes they are. Mostly, and the presumption has to be, in this case, what motive would there be?
Reports from the press were that they weren't even sure it was a murder, that actually maybe the guy had hit his head or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can understand why the police were going to be reluctant, to some extent, to say that it's this or that or the other until they've investigated it. But if it is a racist murder, then there shouldn't be any squeamishness about calling it what it actually is. And those responsible should be pursued as caught and all the rest of it.
And what about this whole thing of other suspects as well? I mean, this is interesting,
well, that's a bigger question, isn't it? It was a Ukrainian neo-Nazi who'd only just been in the country for less than a week who killed her father. And, of course, the suspicion is that he didn't act alone. Just like Breivik, when he killed 60 Labour Party young socialists on Utøya Island, there's big suspicions that he didn't act alone. And in the world we live in, we know that intelligence agencies of various kinds actually carry out terrorist attacks in order to provoke society and to create a sense of fear and basically divide and rule. We know that NATO intelligence services are terrorist enablers, including Islamist terrorism and including right-wing terrorism. And in the past, that's very definitely been the way they've been operating, which is why I've suggested that people should cooperate with local police forces rather than with counter-terrorism and centralised police forces, which tend to be part of the game rather than part of the solution. But I think, the experience of your interviewee there was rather different, that the local police were stuck in a rather racist groove, that the counter-terrorism police were willing to contemplate that it was a politically motivated murder. I don't think there's a I don't think there's hard and fast rules for this, is there?
What were your thoughts, Paul, about this background here? I suppose really my beef is the media coverage. There's very little. I mean, as Maz pointed out there, massive international media coverage for weeks about the death of Lee Rigby, whereas her father was just a blip in the local paper until various people, including myself, made sure that it was pushed out there much, much further.
Yeah, I mean, like saying what Martin's saying there, really, it's it's very sensitive, and like he said, it's very dangerous times we're living in. You know, things are very on the edge a lot of the time, and I think yeah, I agree. I think the police need to be seen that they're actually acting on stuff, you know, and not just letting it go. But then also the media have a responsibility in that as well, you know, to make sure that the actual facts of what's actually happened are getting out there.
Well, that's right.
But really, it's down to divide and rule. That, I mean, looking at a bigger scheme of things, that's what I see it as, is keep people fighting against themselves instead of looking upstairs.
Also, interesting that, you know, that basically the Muslim community in Birmingham were doing a kind of parallel investigation with the police and saying, hang on a minute, there's some CCTV you haven't found here. And that was a way of keeping a check that the police weren't messing around.
Yeah, sure. It's just very, very sad, isn't it?
Also, let's move on to, we mentioned it briefly last week, and it's the wonderful Metro bus, which is causing a lot of traffic jams out there for the whole year, apparently. It's going to be all this year. Chaos on the M32, and I'm not quite sure, if you were to weigh up in the scales somewhere, the advantage of the Metro bus in terms of stopping congestion and things like that, compared to a whole year of traffic jams, whether it's actually going to make any difference at all, really, in the big scheme of things. But I mentioned last week that there is another guided busway type system in another part of the country, that's Cambridge and Luton one, and I was pretty shocked to see that there's been some horrific accidents. Looking in the Cambridge News, this guided bus ended up, I mean, I don't know if you've got the pictures there, folks, but you can see this bus has basically come right off the rails and is sitting in the woods. Another accident which took place just last year ended up with the driver flying through the window of his bus, out through the window into the oncoming bus coming in the opposite direction along one of these tracks, and obviously not necessarily, but the bus just carries on without the driver, with a whole load of passengers down the busway. So these things are not safe. Paul, I wonder what you make of the Metro bus.
Well, we're still in planning stages at the moment, aren't we? They're building it. I mean, it's affecting, I think it's 19 green spaces across the city. It's big money project, isn't it? Again, it's comes down to whose interests are where and things. And I mean, I was kind of involved in the Stapleton allotment demonstrations, a few of my friends up in the trees, campaigning to try and save the blue finger land, some of the, it's grade one agricultural land, some of the best and most fertile land in the whole of Europe to grow on. And it's been tarmacked, and other than losing a fantastic community hub for people to learn how to grow their own food and stuff, again, it comes down to this kind of democratic lack of transparency in democracy, really.
Most of the decisions, Martin, seem to be moved away from our councillors, and even from George, really. I mean, he's had quite a lot to do with it, but to these things like the Local Enterprise Partnership and the West of England Partnership.
Well, the other point I would make is that this is all being run by the private sector, ultimately, for profit. And as a socialist, I just don't believe that that's the right way to do it.
Well, it doesn't matter about that. Surely the most important thing is that we actually have decent public transport that works.
Yes, but the decent public transport that works, what we used to have is a system whereby, for example, you had cross-subsidy so that, you know, the Bristol City Council would run the buses in Bristol. Some routes were profitable, some were not, but it was a networked system. And when it was publicly owned and publicly run, you can actually run the profitable routes with the profit you make from the profitable routes, whereas what we have now is the unprofitable routes have to be subsidised by the taxpayer, and in actual fact we're still subsidising the privately run railways and buses, which is actually just putting money in the pockets of the private shareholders. And you were mentioning last week that First Bus in fact is owned in the United States of America and is bankrupt, so most of the profit that's being
almost bankrupt.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So if people don't use First Bus in Bristol, it might actually tip it over.
So in other words, the profit being made in Bristol on the extortionate fares is going to the United States of America to pay off junk bonds which the first bus have issued. Now, what used to happen under public ownership is that money would be ploughed back into new buses, etc., etc. And we've put up with privately run nonsense in this country for 30 years. Mm. It was a stupid idea from the get-go to make these things privately run. And in London, of course, they've never been able to do it in London because it would have just been a disaster.
But once it's there, Martin, I bet you're going to use it.
No, I don't use it, because for that very reason, I either walk or I don't use it. What you've got to do, if you've got a publicly run concert, I mean, do you remember, what's his name?
You don't.
No, I don't remember. But the whole idea of having joined up transport policy by John Prescott, you remember that? Nothing happened about that. Nothing, because the vested interests of the road lobby and others squashed.
It's the racket. It's a racket.
Well, exactly, and that is the fundamental problem. And things like the road lobby have blocked any kind of serious reform of our transport system for a generation. Now, a whole generation with a rubbish transport system that really starts to knock your your viability as an economy down the drain. But we just put up with it. It should never have happened. It should have been reversed. It hasn't been, and we're still paying the price for John Major's stupidity of allowing it to in the first.
Going on to a national story now, and we had finally the Jimmy Savile report out this week. Five senior BBC employees who knew about the sexual predators but did not act. That was one of the headlines, and yet Dame Janet Smith's report says there were five individuals who could have done something, but she said that they didn't know. I don't think that quite makes very much sense. If you have five people that were investigating Savile while he was at the BBC and yet they didn't know about what was going on, it's a bit of a non sequitur, isn't it? The other thing which made me actually laugh grimly, some black humour really, in this report this week, was the fact that in the 1970s and in the 1980s, early 1980s, the News of the World and other national newspapers actually did exposés on Jimmy Savile in the national press, and yet she says that senior BBC managers didn't know anything about it. So certainly Ted Beston, Callan Conin-Semper, Douglas Muggeridge and others did know about what was going on at the BBC. There was live groping of girls on Top of the Pops by Savile, which was there for everybody to see, and they say they didn't know about it. Esther Ranson was running Childline. We're saying that none of the 72 victims rang Esther Ranson's Childline. And also, they were saying that there's been some sort of change in the culture at the BBC. Well, I don't see that. If you look at what the National Union of Journalists is saying, is there still serious problems with bullying at the BBC right up to this very day. Also, they're still sacking people who are complaining. The two journalists that outed Jimmy Savile at Newsnight, that's Liz McKean and Marion Jones, have been elbowed out, and some say also Tony Blackburn has been elbowed out over this sort of scandal because he's his testimony has been compared to that of senior managers, and the judges, Dame Janet Smith and Dame Linda Moss, have said, well, actually, we don't believe Tony Blackburn. Also, there's been an attempt to conflate Savile with Jimmy Hall. Actually, Savile Stuart Hall, and Stuart wasn't raping, whereas Savile was, and is much more prolific. Savile was connected, of course, to Margaret Thatcher very closely, going to have Christmases over a decade with her at Chequers, also with the royal family and Prince Charles. Savile was intimately connected there too, as he was with the Haute de la Garenne Children's Home over in Jersey. Also, conveniently, the police delayed this report by 10 months, which does make you think what maybe this gave the police and others a chance to have a look at it and see if they needed to alter it. So fantastic amount of different reasons why this is just a total whitewash. Anyway, that's my two halfpence. And I can also say, when I was working at the BBC, I came across serious allegations of child abuse. This was actually when I was working at Wiltshire Sound in Salisbury in 1992, at two children's homes there, which were owned by the deputy leader of the Conservative Party in Salisbury, And we put these to our bosses at the manager at Wiltshire Sound, and 2 weeks later I was told your services are no longer required. So we were also told that the police had investigated these claims and then they found nothing. Well, I think it's pretty clear now that the police had been collaborating with child abusers through those years. They certainly were with the Jimmy Savile experience. So what with people still being bullied and kicked out of the BBC, Martin, this looks to me like it's a criminal elite that have got into the BBC, and I don't believe that this report by Dame Janet Smith and Dame Linda Dobbs has actually got to the truth hardly at all. I think maybe it's going to be more to come out still.
Well, I think the key to all of this, and which I always mention when we cover this topic, is the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which the allegation there, and it's across the everybody but in
this
Northern
Ireland. About Broadcasting House, Martin, and Television Centre and BBC premises.
Yes,
report was focusing on that, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. But I want to mention the King Cora Boys Home because people forget about it. The allegation there is that MI5 were using it as a honey trap. So basically, political figures, mostly loyalist paramilitaries, but not entirely, were going there, having sex with underage boys and being videoed. Now, I think that these people at the top in the BBC and other establishment institutions have been protected because the intelligence services have been using paedophilia as a means of blackmail for political purposes. And that is the hidden part of the iceberg here. That's why a blind eye was turned to Savile. Savile was basically a procurer for others in the establishment. He had access to young people and he passed these people up the line to others. And the purpose of this being covered up is not just because they're all paedophiles, it's because they want to have everybody dirtied up so that they can be blackmailed for, in various ways. And I think that that is really what's been going on here, which is why the establishment is closing ranks to prevent any thorough investigation. But King Cora is the key, and I don't think it was the only children's home where that was going on. But in Northern Ireland, of course, it's all political. That everybody's much sharper about it.
Paul, another couple of aspects to this. There's been no justice for these people since Savile's dead, and yet many of the people who were collaborators in a conspiracy, really, to cover this up, are still walking the streets. Some are dead, but others are not. And so you do wonder, don't you, if you compare that to people who are locked up for not paying their licence fee for the BBC, which is what quite cleverly pointed out on Channel 4 News last night. If you're going to be locked up for not paying your licence fee, why not for a criminal conspiracy to abuse countless children? And also there's been an attack on XRO News, a small news agency in London, which leaked an early version, a draft of this report, not only by Dame Janet Smith and Dame Linda Dobbs themselves, but also by a Panorama programme last, I think it was October and November, which the Metropolitan Police, to their credit, said that they thought the programme was irresponsible because it discouraged victims, survivors, from coming to the police.
Yeah. Again, it comes down to what the visible crimes are and the invisible crimes. My kind of example in Bristol of something recently that happened was police going around the city centre and harassing buskers and a woman called Lily that I've met. She sells her art on the street, not bothering anyone. But yet they're not going into Boots and saying, pay your tax, your unpaid tax. Because what's visible and what isn't. And I think we're entering a new age at the moment of transparency. And, yeah, like people really, really asking questions about everything, about all institutions, the media, the police, the government, it's all starting to crumble down, and people are really starting to ask.
What you're saying, it sounds to me as if the police are just going for the easy targets. If someone is powerful, rich, well connected, then the police will just go around them.
Well, also, I mean, you know, the police are facing massive cuts at the moment as well. So, you know, instead of being able to focus on certain things, they're having to just kind of, you know, sit back and not maybe go into what they were going into before. So actually, you know, it's interesting to see where the money comes from and where it's being spent.
Bristol City Council's top executives to receive £5,000 pay rise, while the lowest paid get only £8.25 an hour, Paul.
Well, that's really interesting to me. One of my kind of campaigns for the mayoral elections in the race is to open up transparency about how much people are being paid in Bristol City Council. I think it's Nicola Yates, the head of Bristol City Council. She's now on £194,000.
We've actually several times I've asked for her to come on the programme here. No, she doesn't.
I've never heard her say anything. Literally, I've never heard her say anything on any. She sits at council meetings.
So is she the highest paid? Maybe the legal head of legal services might have managed to wangle more money.
I think she is. I think that now she's the highest paid.
But she should.
There's 194,000, but then there's all the rest. I think she's on the board of directors at the Bristol Green Capital as well. So there's all the extra bits and bobs as well. And I mean, this is what I was saying to you earlier, Tony. We're basically being faced with massive cuts to frontline essential services in our city. We're told that austerity is required to sort out balance the books, but there's no cutbacks at the top in management at Bristol City Council.
Almost sounds like hush money, doesn't it? It's like, well, you could be, well, double your pay, but keep your mouth shut.
What's hush money? What do you mean?
Hush money? Mm. Well, this is used by the mafia, Martin, isn't it? These kinds of people.
Mm. Well, obviously. But there's going to be question marks about the allocation of resources at a time when austerity is being forced down the throats of the poorest in the community. You know, people like David Cameron, who are probably earning, you know, less than some top civil servants, moan and groan and say, look, I'm making a sacrifice by being the Prime Minister. And you've got to remember, for the people like him and Osborne, being a politician is a hobby. They're basically multimillionaires. They don't need the salary. And I think that most people have no real idea who's paid what or why. The Duke of Westminster, I mentioned earlier, who's the biggest landowner in Britain, he will become massively wealthier as a result of a property bubble in London. He doesn't have to do anything, he just has to sit there and he becomes massively wealthier. That is society allocating resources.
Well, he's got to do something, maybe play golf.
Well, yeah, the point is that the allocation of resources. Do people realise that we pay 2p in the pound on income tax to clear up nuclear waste? 2p in the pound on income tax.
Before the 6 o'clock news, I'd just like to get in. We'll go to the other end of the scale here, because the mentally ill getting no money and having their benefits cut came up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Yeah. Indeed, Mr. Speaker. My constituent, Frank Wason, is on long-term sick leave due to severe depression, but he is no longer entitled to sick pay, was turned down for ESA and cannot claim JSA due to his job being kept open for him. Mr. Wason cannot leave his highly skilled job as a chef due to the threat of punitive sanctions, leaving him with no income. Will the Prime Minister look at Mr. Wason's case specifically, but also the wider issue of people with mental health issues who are unable to work, being expected to live on fresh air?
I'm very happy to look at the individual case, because the way our benefit system should work is clear, that if you are unable to work, but with help could work, you should go on to employment and support allowance on the work-related activity group and get that help. If you're unable to work, you go on to the support group, you get a higher amount of money, it's not means-tested, it's not time-limited. For people who have mental health issues and difficulties, you've also got the new personal independence payment system, which can address some of those. So quite rightly, for a generous and compassionate country, we have a benefit system that supports those who cannot work, while making sure that those who can work are encouraged to do so.
Paul, benefit sanctions for the mentally ill. Actually, no money at all.
Right, well, my experience of the mental health world, if you like, is I was sectioned back in 2004. I was on the ward for about 2.5 months. My personal experience of mental health was, it was a very scary time. Forget all the money and all the rest. I didn't know what I was doing, you know. I really needed a place where I felt safe. So kind of all the, you know, the talk about payments and blah blah, I wasn't interested in money. I was interested in getting well. And thank the NHS for that, really.
Well, I think it's absolutely ridiculous that anybody other than a doctor should decide who's fit for work and who isn't. Why some unqualified person being allowed to make those decisions? Completely wrong.
Okay, it's time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, we'll be talking about the F-35. This is the so-called scamjet, which we're paying £20 billion for, that doesn't work.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.